Good evening and welcome everyone to the regular meeting of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency for January 16th, 2024. And with that, I'd like to call the meeting to order and move on to item two, Pledge of Allegiance. And I'd like to ask Vice President Kutsite if you would kindly lead us in the pledge tonight.
Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Vice President Kutsite. I have a few announcements to make tonight. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the board using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. We do have members of the public present, so I would remind those members that there are public comment cards in the lobby area just outside the door. Please use those to help facilitate the public comment process. Procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from board members. Please raise your hand if you have a comment or a question from the board. Once concluded, I will ask for a motion and a second. After any further discussion, the board secretary will call for roll call votes. All directors are present for tonight's meeting, and we will continue the meeting and move on to item three, public comment. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda at this time. We ask that members of the public wishing to comment on items that are listed on this agenda do so at the time each item is considered. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in closed session should be considered by the board must request to make comments at the commencement of the meeting at 6 p.m. I do not have any public comment cards for item three. Do we have any members of the public online who wish to make comment under item three?
We do have a member of the public who has a public comment, but I believe that he wants to speak on item number five. Mr. Stone, should I just ask him? Okay. Mr. Williams? I see that you have your hand up. Are you making public comment on item five?
I believe so. Sorry, I didn't get a good look at the agenda.
Okay, then we'll have public comment at the end of the presentations for item five. Thank you.
Do we have any members of the public who wish to make comment on the closed session items tonight?
It does not appear so.
Very good. We can move on to item four, approval of the agenda. Are there any changes to the January 16, 2024 board agenda from our board? Seeing none, the agenda is hereby approved, and we can move on to item five, special procedures. Item 5.1, an update on the Delta Conveyance Project to modernize the state water project infrastructure, presented by the Department of Water Resources Environmental Project Manager, Carrie Buckman, and Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority Executive Director, Graham Bradner. I will pass this to Matt to make the introductions. Mr. Stone.
Thank you, President Martin. I'm actually going to, I think Steve, you're ready to, we got a couple of preamble slides from the agency, just kind of bringing the board up to speed on a short history of our board actions on this item, and then we'll lead into introduction of the two presenters tonight. So, Steve, will you take that?
Definitely. Thank you.
As Matt said, we just want to give a real quick overview of some of the history. Next slide, April. So we'll just talk very simplistically about some of these. They have quite the history involved with them, but I think we thought it would be good to just bring the board kind of back to center on the context of some of these. So we'll talk about just the past conveyance efforts, some history highlights, and then schedule next steps. Next slide, April. As I said, simplistic graphics here. So here's a graphic kind of running through the history of what has become Delta Conveyance. There was always a project that was considered as part of the state water project system that turned into what was known as the peripheral canal. And that became, over time, a through Delta facility that was going to look at strengthening levees and things like that to move water more reliably through the Delta. That ended up becoming what was known as the Water Fix or Twin Tunnels project. And then we come full forward to today with the Delta Conveyance Facility, which is a 6,000 CFS facility. And we'll hear much more about that with our presenters later tonight. Next slide, April. Just a few of the highlights we kind of picked out to share with the board. Again, the actions that moved along with the various versions of this project over time are listed here. A couple of those key actions, the agency approved its participation in Water Fix. We switched governors. The new governor had a different idea, which was to move to a single tunnel project. And so that's what the direction was to the Department of Water Resources, and they started preparing a notice of preparation to work through that project and compare it to the other projects. We also worked through some Delta Conveyance Facility Agreement and Principles. We've also, in November, a few years back, we informed DWR of our 2.6% participation level. We also executed a planning cost agreement, and we joined Design Construction Authority for the project. And then most recently, you'll probably all be familiar with that Department of Water Resources has certified the final environmental impact report at the end of last year. Next slide, April. Just a little bit more on kind of the planning schedule. It's been a long road here, and I'm sure both our presenters tonight can talk about some of that. You can see that in the kind of the cyan color in the middle, that's the final EIR has been certified. There's also the kind of federal component of that, the EIS that will follow here at the beginning of this year. And then you can see the other environmental processes are still going to have to continue as far as getting the project fully permitted going forward. Called out at the bottom is a couple key dates that are going to be coming before you all for consideration. One, as the project will be performing a new cost estimate, so we'll get an updated idea of what the project cost is based on most recent information. There's also going to be a statewide cost benefit analysis that is completed for the project. So this is looking at the benefit of the project for the state as a whole and what it means. And then the agency is going to be needing to consider the kind of the next round of funding for the project to continue it moving forward. Next slide, April. So as I said, this was quick, just to get you real orientated back to where things are. Next steps, ongoing permitting through early 27, updated cost estimate in the spring of 24, the statewide cost benefit analysis more towards the middle of this year, and then a request on the commit to additional funding of our share for the project. I've put that at 2024 here. I think you'll possibly hear some alternatives to that, depending on how the project is scoped out to move forward. Next slide, April. So with that, Matt, do you want to do the introductions? Or would you like me to just continue on? I'll continue on. We're lucky tonight to have Graham Bradner, who is the Executive Director of the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority. Graham has been doing a tremendous job of getting this project to the current state. So we'll get to hear from him tonight. And then we have Carrie Buckman, who's the Environmental Program Manager for the California Department of Water Resources, and obviously had a really heavy lift to get the environmental document prepared and adopted at the end of the year. So with that, I'll conclude, and we'll have Carrie and Graham come up. Thanks.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having us tonight. We're really happy to be here. It's nice to actually be at a person in-person meeting, and we really appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you tonight. So I'm going to start us off and talk a little bit about why we're considering the Delta Conveyance Project. Graham's going to provide a little bit more detail about what the project is and some of the considerations and the conceptual design. And then I'll talk a little bit more at the end about permitting and next steps. So April, I think we can move to the next slide. So starting off a little bit with why the State Water Project is important to California, and I think these first few slides are probably a bit repetitive to you guys, but just bear with me a little bit. So the State Water Project is a really important feature to the state as a whole in California. 3 out of 5 Californians depend on water that flows through the Delta. 2/3 of California's water originates in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and about 50% of California's water supplies flow through the Delta. There are 29 state water contractors, including Santa Clarita Valley, that purchase and distribute water through the State Water Project. And that water provides clean, affordable drinking water to 27 million people and about 750,000 acres of farmland. And one other thing that I wanted to mention is that we recently did an economic investigation that looked at the benefits of the State Water Project to the state. And I think people hear a lot about the figure that if California was a country, our economy would be the 5th largest in the world. And if the State Water Project service area was a country, it would be the 8th largest economy in the world. This is a really important feature, and it provides a lot of important benefits to the recipients. Next slide, please. And again, this is just a reminder to me, probably mostly, that the State Water Project is an important feature for Santa Clarita. While there is a suite of water supplies for your agency, State Water Project is an important imported water supply, providing almost 70% of the imported water supply to the agency. Next slide, please. So because the State Water Project is so important, that really leads us to try to proactively plan for climate change. We don't want to be in the position where we're responding and reacting. We need to make sure that the State Water Project is able to provide stable water supplies into the future. And so we know that we need to prepare for climate change. The exact details of climate change are somewhat uncertain. We know that the amount of runoff could change in unpredictable ways. So major forecasts show either a decrease of 32% of annual runoff up to an increase of 47%. So while the amount of runoff is variable in these different scenarios, there tends to be a lot of agreement about other factors with climate change. So there is a lot of agreement that in California, we're going to see more precipitation falling as rain instead of snow. So in winter months, we'll see more rain, less snow. We're expecting more extreme drought and flood cycles, and that has been borne out in the last few years. We've seen that pretty dramatically in the last 3 to 5 years. We also expect flashier storms. So we'll have pockets of pretty intense precipitation within dry stretches. And this change in how the water system would function means that we can't necessarily capture and move water during the winter. We're pretty restricted because of flood protection and fishery flow and water quality requirements. So that does limit how we would be able to capture this water with climate change. Next slide. And our water management system is designed on the historical water pattern. So existing facilities are designed to capture water when it was available, which is really primarily during snowmelt. So during the winter, we would see snow in the mountains and rain in the valley. And that snow really functioned as additional storage, delaying water until the spring. And that gave us an opportunity to capture that water. And that historical pattern of snowpack followed by slower snowmelt is the basis for typical water and flood management. So we know that as we're changing and we're looking at more precipitation falling as rain, less snowpack, and a shorter duration of when we're likely to see those high runoffs, we really need to be able to adjust our water management strategies to be able to address those changes. Next slide, please. So how would the Delta Conveyance Project help with this changing climate? Adding intakes in the North Delta would allow the capture and movement of water in the winter that would otherwise be unavailable. So right now in the South Delta during the winter, we have a lot of fishery and flow requirements that limit the amount that we can capture. And similarly, in reservoirs, we have limited ability to hold water because we need to keep an available amount of storage open so that if there is a flood, we can help with that flood management. So additional diversions in the North Delta during those really high flow periods will allow us to move the water when it's available and store it for when it's needed. So modernizing this infrastructure will also help with seismic risk. We understand that if there is a seismic event in the Delta, most likely that would mean an influx of water from the ocean, really much more saline conditions in the Delta, and potentially an outage of months to over a year for the State Water Project. And we need to be able to have that protection to address that, which will be exacerbated with sea level rise as we move into the future. Next slide, please. And I wanted to highlight what happens if the Delta Conveyance Project does not come online. So we understand that as climate is changing, we'll have less ability to capture water. And we have what we call a declining baseline, and that's shown on this slide in blue. So as we go forward from now into the future, we'll be able to capture and move less water, and that means deliver less water without the project. With the Delta Conveyance Project, we increase deliveries. It's about 500,000 acre feet of water average annual. And right now that does look like an increase, but you have to really factor in the idea that that's a declining baseline, and we need this in order to help stabilize the water supplies into the future. Next slide, please. And, you know, we talk a lot about modeling results and simulations to talk about what the project would do in the future, but I did want to highlight a little bit of sort of real world information. So I mentioned that in the last few years, we've seen a lot of what we think climate change will look like in the future. So in 21-22, that water year was critically dry. But I don't know if you remember, there were a couple of really big storms. In October, we had a record-setting storm. It was, I think, over 5 inches of precipitation in Sacramento. And then in December, the very end of December, between like Christmas and New Year's, we had another really large storm system. And if we'd been able to capture water during and immediately after those storm systems in the Delta Conveyance Project, if the project had been online, we would have been able to capture an additional 236,000 acre feet of water, which is enough water to provide over 2.5 million people drinking water for a year, or nearly 850,000 households. Also, for those who think about State Water Project allocation, that's about a 5% bump in the State Water Project allocation. And during a year where there was just so little water available, that would have been really important. And then not last year, in January of 2023, we did have a wetter year last year, but it didn't necessarily start off really clear where we were going. And in January, we had a very wet storm system come through, and we were very limited with our diversions in the South Delta. So having an additional point of diversion would have allowed additional diversions of about 228,000 acre feet of water, which is enough water to supply over 2.3 million people for a year, or nearly 800,000 households. Next slide. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Graham to go over the projects.
Good evening. Thank you, Carrie. And thanks again, directors, for inviting us here today. So I'm going to talk about two components of the project. First, the concept designs that have been evaluated through the environmental analyses and are the basis for selection of the Bethany Reservoir alternative through certification of the EIR. And then talk a little bit about next steps on the engineering front. So first, what is the project? As I mentioned, the Bethany alignment. It's a 6,000 cubic foot per second project. That would be two intakes in the North Delta along the main stem of the Sacramento River, a new pumping plant in the South Delta. This would be adjacent to the federal and state facilities that are also in the South Delta, but this would be a new dedicated pumping plant that would discharge water lifting out of the tunnel, but discharging through a set of pipeline aqueducts directly into Bethany Reservoir. Bethany Reservoir is the head, sort of the top of the California aqueduct and is the beginning of the journey south from there. Just looking at some of the statistics and numbers, it's two intakes in the north, each intake with a capacity of up to 3,000 cubic feet per second. It's one below ground tunnel, 36 foot internal diameter, a total length of 45 miles to get from those intakes in the north, skirting along the eastern margins of the Delta, then connecting with the existing State Water Project infrastructure in the South Delta. It's about 45 miles. Tunnel depth on the order of 140 to 170 feet below ground surface. And then the segmental concrete lining, those are on track to be 18 inches thickness for the tunnel liner segments. You can see on the right-hand side, the image shows the Delta. You can see the intakes in, with the blue dots in the north, the different shafts that would be needed to construct, and then connecting to those facilities in the far south, south of Clifton Court Forebay. Next slide, please, April. So looking at these major project facilities, the intakes, there's a render showing those in the north. Those intakes generally just function by gravity. The only pumps within the system are down in the South Delta to tilt the hydraulic grade line and begin diverting operations. There would be a number of shafts constructed along the tunnel alignment. Those are needed mainly for tunnel construction with tunnel boring machines, and then would be left behind as part of the permanent infrastructure to support future operations and maintenance, but also to manage surge within the system. The pumping plant that's down in the south is mostly a below grade pumping plant. The vast majority of the facilities would all be subterranean. And then an outlet structure on the rim of Bethany Reservoir would be a new dedicated outlet structure. The existing Banks pumping plant that provides State Water Project water already discharges into Bethany Reservoir. This would just be a second discharge location that's completely independent from the existing facilities. Next slide, please. So there are a number of advantages associated with the Bethany Reservoir alternative, and I've also added some graphics on the right-hand side to try and put these in context. So starting in the north at the intakes, the project would use state-of-the-art fish screens. These are cylindrical T-screens compared to the more conventional vertical plate screens. These are much more efficient from a space perspective. They have much more efficient cleaning technology, and they allow for an overall substantially smaller footprint associated with the intakes. If you can shrink the intake frontage along the river, you're able to then shrink the entire footprint of the intakes, including the perimeter embankments that surround those sedimentation basins. The project is able to construct the entire 45 miles from two tunnel launch locations. Those locations are strategically located to be in position to handle the type of construction equipment and construction access that would be needed for a project of this magnitude. The location in the north is immediately adjacent to Interstate 5. The location in the south is directly adjacent to the Port of Stockton, with also very good access from Interstate 5, Highway 4, and other major roads that surround the area. In doing that, we're able to completely avoid any major construction activities through the heart of the Delta, where the logistical challenges are much more substantial and much more difficult to overcome. We also, within the project, have a very heavy reliance on buried power lines. So where we do have new power required for the project, and there's not already existing power lines strung on towers, then those new lines would be buried. And that's all included in the environmental analysis, and the construction effort to bury those lines is included in the project. And that's to manage and mitigate potential bird strikes associated with migratory patterns within the Delta. The new pumping plant in the south would be positioned on high ground relative to Delta elevations and other pumping plants and facilities in the area. Just for reference, there are many elevations within the Delta that are below zero, below sea level. The new pumping plant would be up around elevation 50, which would position it far above any projections of future sea level rise conditions that could eventually potentially impact infrastructure in the area. Having that direct discharge into Bethany Reservoir provides the state operators the ultimate amount of flexibility to control how they divert when opportunities arise and how to manage water quality and other issues in the Delta. There would be no new four bays or barge landings constructed as part of the project. This was determined through quite a bit of alternatives evaluation, but for the Bethany Reservoir alternative, there is not a need for a new at-grade reservoir or intermediate four bays to manage the water issues, nor are there a need for new barge landings associated with construction. Overall, the lack of four bays, which would be Division of Safety of Dams jurisdictional facilities, as well as the lack of barge landings, dramatically reduces the impacts on waters and wetlands in the Delta area. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to shift gears to upcoming focus. So Carrie mentioned, Steve mentioned in the prelude, the upcoming cost estimate. So I want to talk a minute about that. This is a focus for the DCA engineering team at this point. The last cost assessment was released in 2020, coming in at $15.9 billion in 2020 dollars. At this point, we will be updating that estimate to 2023 dollars. We plan to release the estimate in quarter two of this year. We are taking every piece of that estimate and fully evaluating and really interrogating every piece of it, including updated design footprints for the recommended project, updated contingencies and risk mitigation costs that are built into that estimate. We've developed full soft costs, so we're not using percent-based assumptions at this point for estimating all of the management, engineering, design costs, but rather building those up with crews and personnel, updating all the property right away for the project, as well as the environmental conceptual mitigation design costs. All of these will go into what we're referring to as a primary estimate for the project that exactly matches that described in the EIR and certified through DWR's evaluation. In addition, we're evaluating potential cost savings concepts. And so these are taking into account additional subsurface information that we've been collecting over the past several years, as well as evaluating opportunities to improve constructability, reconsider refined design assumptions, and look for opportunities to innovate within the industry. The tunneling industry is a constantly innovating industry, and there are opportunities within the industry to continue to look for ways that we could make the project more constructible, potentially reduce costs. So that's something that we're also evaluating as we go through the cost estimate, and we'll be willing to be able to talk more about that when we release that estimate in quarter two of this year. Next slide, please. Also on the design development side, we've got still to complete a preferred project engineer's report. And so this will be a report that documents all of the engineering considerations of the Bethany Reservoir alternative. The current documentation includes all alternatives, has a number of addendums and supplements. And so our next action would be to take the recommended project and create a succinct report that documents all of the engineering considerations that have gotten us this far. This will be the last engineering deliverable as part of our current planning and permitting scope of work. At the same time, we're starting to consider the next phase to work in parallel to the remaining permit activities, which would be to help evolve the design from its concept level currently to something that more resembles a preliminary design. This will be done through a process of additional geotechnical and environmental data collection, a lot of survey information that we need to collect. Through that process, we will again need to reconsider property access and potential land acquisition for the future. There could be certainly a need to onboard our future design teams for various facilities, depending on what level of design we think we can get to with the available data. And then lastly, there could be portions of the environmental mitigation that we need to start considering in our window and time frame, and start looking at what that will take as we approach the implementation stage. So next slide, and I think that's it for me. I'll hand it back to Carrie.
So I want to also highlight some of the community engagement that we've been working on as we've been developing the project and going through the beginning of the permitting work. So we've really been focused on reaching out to environmental justice and disadvantaged communities. We talked to statewide EJ experts and developed a series of best management practices, and they really focused on trying to reach communities where they are rather than asking them to come to us. So going to town meetings, going to farmers markets, and what we call tabling, where we set up tables and have people come where they already are there and really don't ask as much of them in terms of time. We have a formal tribal consultation and informal tribal coordination process. We sent letters to 121 tribes to ask for interested parties who wanted to consult on this project. And we ended up with about 13 tribes in formal consultation, and then other tribes that spoke to us informally as well. And that did lead to an impact analysis of tribal cultural resources in the EIR that identified the importance of the entire Delta as a tribal cultural landscape and worked to identify mitigation to help reduce effects to the entire Delta landscape. We had Delta community engagement through the Stakeholder Engagement Committee that the DCA led to obtain local insight during conceptual design process. So we really wanted to start off by doing what we could to reduce the effects to the local communities and the environment before we even got to the environmental analysis and the CEQA process. We also have been developing a community benefits program that I'm going to talk about in the next few slides, and just a suite of overall outreach materials. We recognize that an EIR might not be something that a lot of people want to sit down and read cover to cover. So we've been really trying to identify different ways to reach different audiences. We had videos with our technical experts. We had a shorter document that summarized the EIR, not just an executive summary, but sort of a more reader-friendly, not CEQA-focused version. So trying to have a lot of different ways for people to engage and learn about the project. Next slide. So the community benefits program is a really important piece to me of the project. This is included as part of the project, and it's really developed to acknowledge that the benefits of the Delta Conveyance Project would be to the state water project supply, but that is not felt within the area that would be affected by construction. So as part of the CEQA process, we have identified impacts and we mitigate for those impacts. So we avoid or reduce those impacts to the extent we can. But we recognize that CEQA is pretty prescriptive about the kinds of impacts that it considers, and it may not fully address all of the things that will be experienced by the communities during construction. So in addition, we've developed this community benefits program, and this would be on top of the required mitigation under CEQA. Next slide, please. So right now, we've been working with the community to develop this program. The EIR did include a framework for the program as part of the EIR project description, but we are going to be working this year to help develop it further. So based on discussions with the community, there are two key pieces. One of them is a Delta Community Fund, which would be a grant program to support community prioritized projects in the Delta. And the second is project implementation commitments. So this could include things like hiring targets, job training, education, use of local businesses, and the potential to have what we call leave behinds in terms of infrastructure or facilities. So an easy example is that we have some park and ride facilities that would be included in construction. If the local communities would like those to remain, then we can leave them instead of removing them as a leave behind piece of infrastructure. Next slide, please. So we did just reach a really major milestone on the planning and permitting side, which I'm pretty excited about. So we had the draft environmental impact report. We released that in July of 2022, and the comment period closed in December of 2022. We had a 142-day comment period with 730 letters and other communications. When we subdivided those into individual comments, we had about 7,300 individual comments. They covered a really broad range of topics, and we responded to those within the final EIR. And we released that final EIR in December and certified it on December 21st, which is a pretty big milestone to move the project forward. Next slide. But while that was a really major milestone, I think one of the things I want to highlight is that it's just part of the planning process. I'd say it's the first major milestone, and it's a big one, but there's a lot of work still remaining on the planning and permitting side. So the National Environmental Policy Act is the federal counterpart to CEQA, and the Corps of Engineers is the lead agency, and they're working to finalize the environmental impact statement that they released in 2022. We're expecting it later this year. They're an independent entity. They're not a project proponent. They're a regulating agency, so they're reviewing this from a regulatory perspective. So they will finish when it's right for them on their schedule, and that will be sometime this year, middle of the year, I think. The state and federal endangered species acts are another key process that we're really engaging in at the moment. So we have the federal process, which at the moment is split into two pieces. We're looking at an operations part and a construction part. So the construction piece is led by the Corps as an accompaniment to the work that they're doing on the regulatory side. And that will be at a project-specific level in detail because construction would start at the end of the permitting process. The operations piece is a little different because we're not looking at operating the facility until construction is complete, which is around 2040. And that's really a long way away when conditions could change pretty dramatically within the water and science community. We may know more about endangered species. We may know different things. So what we're doing there is we're having a programmatic consultation. So it's more general. It's not as detailed. It lays out a set of principles that we would meet in order to avoid jeopardizing endangered species. And then we would have another consultation process before we begin operations. On the state side, there isn't that option to have a program level. So we are having a detailed consultation process on both construction and operations. For the State Water Resources Control Board, we are going to be asking for a change in point of diversion for our water rights. We are not asking to increase our water rights. We're just adding another point of diversion. So in addition to our existing point in the South Delta, we would be able to divert at the new intakes in the North Delta. So we will submit our petition early this year. There would be about a 60-day protest period where parties can protest that petition, and then that would move to a hearing in front of the State Board to consider that change. We are going to work to continue development of the community benefits program through meetings with the community. We want to make sure that the things that we're considering are what is desired and needed by the community. And so that process will continue this year with public outreach and public meetings. As Graham mentioned, we are working to revise the cost estimate and develop a cost-benefit analysis, and that is expected in Q2 this year. And through all of this, we will be continuing public outreach and engagement. Next slide. So this is a little bit more detail about this next year, because there really is quite a bit going on in the next year. So on here, the green items are on the planning and permitting side. The blue are more technical engineering, and then the orange is a public outreach element. So coming up pretty quickly, so as I mentioned, we released the final EIR in December. And we also, in blue here, you see the statewide State Water Project Economic Study. And I mentioned that earlier that we have this study that documents some of the important elements of the State Water Project. It's not a Delta Conveyance Project study. It's done for DWR as a whole, but I did want to mention it because it has some information that helps understand some of the importance of this project to DWR as the owner and operator of the State Water Project. So moving into 2024, you can see the black dot indicates where we are now. Our next major milestone will be the submission of the change in point of diversion petition to the State Water Resources Control Board. And then moving into Q2, the major milestones in Q2 will be the updated cost estimate and benefit cost analysis, which are shown here as two dots, but we're really expecting this to be out at the same time. After that, we will be having community workshops and updates. That's shown as A square, but really that's sort of over a 3 to 4 month period that we're expecting during the middle of the year. Then we're looking at having our Endangered Species Act, California Endangered Species Act, complete in Q3, along with a final environmental impact statement from the Corps and starting the water rights hearing after that. And then Graham mentioned the preferred project engineers report, and that is expected at the beginning of Q4. So there's a lot going on, and we're really happy for this opportunity to sort of talk through it and answer any questions you might have. And I think that's the end, April, if we want to just go to the next slide.
Yep.
So President Martin, however you want to do this.
Thank you, Ms. Buckman, for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Bradner, for your presentation. We very much appreciate you coming down, speaking to us tonight about the project. Before we open up to board questions or discussion, I know we have one written public comment. We did have a member online who wanted to make public comment, April.
We do. We have quite a few. Let's see. Let's start with the top. Mr. Williams, go ahead. You may begin your public comment. Just 1 second, actually. I'm sorry. Let me put up the timer. Mr. Williams, you may begin your public comment. Mr. Williams? How about we come back to Mr. Oh, there it goes. Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Okay.
Your public comment.
My name is Dr. Tom Williams. I have a doctorate in geology and zoology, 1976, from UC Berkeley, and taught geology at UC Davis. I participated in the Board of Water Resources meetings for the last tunnel project, which led to its demise. The fix is in the wrong project at the wrong location for the whole thing. This conveyance is even worse, what you're proposing. It's longer, it's more complicated, and when you're in soft ground, you don't want complications. I urge you not to support either or both the Delta conveyance and its sidekick sites reservoir for water rights of flood flows only. I did environmental assessments for Black Butte Reservoir and several others within the San Joaquin Valley, and was environmental control supervisor for construction management of the LA, RTD, MTA, Red Line, downtown Los Angeles, phase one. I know tunnels. So I've done about 300 EIRs, EISs worldwide, and thank you very much for tonight's presentation, including in Shanghai, which has similar ground conditions to that of the Delta. So you have the proposed worst possible place for tunnels in the state of California, especially with the tunnels having bends, dips, and shafts, and all sorts of other fixed points and a quagmire of virtually liquid mud. Okay, the project site includes gas production and storage facilities, which we know something about because I participated in the Porter Ranch Lucio Canyon disaster and on the how to fix it side. Remember that mess? And that could easily cause gargantuan change orders during the construction of any of the tunnels and even shafts. Part of the reason for the tunnel is to withstand earthquakes. And in a quagmire like the Delta, they could easily destroy the tunnel if occurring, especially during the prolonged construction period. And when you have a flexible tunnel connected to a fixed vertical shaft, you got a basic problem of its survival. So I would expect you to be experiencing stranded construction assets without any flows, because it's going
Thank
to take
you, sir,
a long
for your
time
public
to
comment. That does end your public comment.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, for your public comment. It's not generally our policy to respond to public comment necessarily, but Graham, I'd like to give you the opportunity, if you so choose, if you'd like to respond in any way.
President Martin, we do have a member of the public who's online that's catching a flight. Would you mind if we take him first?
Okay.
Mr. Wilson, you may begin your public comment.
Thank you, Mr. President. As your staff just alluded to, I actually am sitting in the Sacramento airport following a day where I've actually been with over 500 members of disadvantaged communities and communities of color engaged in conversations with legislative leaders about the very specific need for capital investment into water infrastructure to provide a water resilient future for the state of California, and how important that is for disadvantaged communities. As I listen to the program tonight and the overview, I have to actually commend DCA for what has gone on in this process. Since we have moved from the twin tunnel proposal to this new defined single tunnel, the outreach, the communication, the coordination, the inclusion of communities, and the flexibility that's designed into this is truly significant from where we were just a few short years ago. Clearly, there's still a lot to do, as you also heard tonight. But what we do know, what we know categorically, is that the modernization of the state's water infrastructure, specifically the State Water Project, is not an option. It absolutely must go forward to provide a resilient future for the entirety of the state, not just for one region over another. That fits also, as you saw from Governor Newsom, who has fully vested himself in this project and in this process. He clearly understands the importance that fixing the Sacramento Bay Delta is to this particular state. It's common sense from sort of where we sit that to make the state work, climate change is already there. We've already seen it. We have dry years. We've had wet years. Had we had this in place, the climate's not waiting for us. And I think the process where we are today is dramatically different and improved from where we were. I commend the state for where they are, and we look forward to doing continued outreach and education to see this through as we go through these next important milestones. Thank you.
Thank you for your public comment.
We have any other public comment, April?
We do. Did you want Graham to answer the first public
comment? Yeah, I'd like to, yes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, President Martin. So as the commenter described, I mean, there are challenging ground conditions in the Delta. That is true. But the realities of the project are that, first of all, I'll sort of go through the laundry list in my head. The new project would be designed to modern standards. Those design criteria standards are much more robust than what could have been or has been considered for the current facilities. Just to speak about some of the major elements for the surface facilities that are easy to access after a strong shaking event, they're still designed to a standard, the maximum credible earthquake standard, which is 975-year return period event, so nearly a 1,000-year return period event for all the surface facilities. The tunnel itself and, the deeper infrastructure that's more difficult to get to is designed for a maximum credible earthquake, just under 2,500-year return period, 2475 return period event. So it would be designed for a very strong shaking event. The tunnel itself would be constructed down in more consolidated deposits. So there are very loose deposits, which are an issue for surface facilities, built on top of those soft peat, deposits. Those are mushy and very difficult to deal with from an engineering perspective. But the project, the tunnel would be excavated below those deposits in much more densely consolidated deposits, many thousands of years old much more consolidated. It also helps to reduce the effects of amplification. So surface facilities have the amplification effects as seismicity travels through especially loose saturated soils, but being down in those more consolidated deposits ensures that the facilities will perform better than anything built on top of those soft deposits. And then lastly, where we do have to deal with potential crossings if and when, we're not to the point now where we know as much as we will during the final design phase. We still have a lot of subsurface investigation and characterization to do. But when the time comes, if we do have fault crossings that we need to deal with, the elements of the concrete segmental lining can be augmented. That can be through steel reinforcement. It can be through linings. It can be through steel plates. I mean, there's a number of ways to deal with specific issues that can occur. The commenter's not wrong that the interfaces are a challenge. And once again, all that has to be resolved through very, very detailed engineering with a lot of subsurface investigation and testing that supports that. So all that will come. And also just responding to the gas well issue. And I mean, again, that is true. There's a lot of gas production in the area. There's gas infrastructure within the Delta. All of that has to be identified, navigated, managed as we would for any other project. So, but do appreciate the opportunity.
Graham, before we move on to other public comments, I know your role is the overall program executive director, but could you brief our board on your professional credentials in geotechnical engineering?
Sure. So I've been working in water supply infrastructure for 20 years, mostly dams, levees, water supply distribution systems, pipelines. My credentials are professional geologist, certified engineering geologist, and certified hydrogeologist, all within California.
Thank you. Madam Secretary, do we have public comment? Other?
We do. Katie Wagner, go ahead. You may begin your public comment.
Thank you. My name is Katie Wagner. I'm with Sierra Club, California. The tunnel will not bring about a new source of water and will eventually become stranded assets. DWR refused public comments on the final EIR for the Delta Tunnel, which shows a lack of willingness to engage with the public, even after stating in their press conference that they recognize the entire Bay Delta is part of the cultural and tribal landscape designated by at least 13 tribes to be in need of protection. When Ms. Buckman discusses mitigation for the tribes, that includes moving sacred sites and burial sites. The EIR says that all tribes preferred a no-tunnel alternative. She mentioned that DWR is now trying to meet communities where they're at, which I assume is in response to the feedback they got in 2020 when tribes had to drive 5 hours in a pandemic and wildfire season to attend those meetings. The projects will cost money, be further tied up with lawsuits, and if they were to be built, will likely not be complete until the late 2040s at the earliest. Ms. Buckman said construction would be complete by 2040, but if construction started at the earliest in 2028 with these new updated timelines, with the minimum construction period of 16 years per the FEIR, that would be 2044, but the lawsuits against the tunnel have already begun, and how often does construction finish on time? Mr. Bradner talked about seismic activity, but didn't mention that the 400 miles of aqueduct south of the tunnel are vulnerable to earthquakes and cross the San Andreas Fault, and that's not part of the project. DWR's own survey of environmental justice communities found that 90% of respondents say they eat fish from the Delta 4 or more times per week. The tunnel's construction and operation will severely impair this access to subsistence fishing. This year is now the sixth year in a row that no Delta smelt have been found in the Delta. Stockton is in the top 5% of areas in the country for poor air quality. Construction will require 150 truck trips per day, which amounts to about 100,000 truck trips, further polluting the air for underserved communities. Ms. Buckman mentioned that the State Water Project area is the eighth largest economy in the world. If DWR is sure that the tunnel will be supported by so many people, then why not put it to a vote by the public? The last public referendum on the tunnel was in 1982, when the public overwhelmingly voted against it, and it has since only been up for a vote by water agencies. The public does not want this project that will cost money and destroy the Bay Delta. A vote for the tunnel would gamble billions of dollars in an era of unpredictable climate change. That money would be better spent in local groundwater storage, conservation, and efficiency. Thank you.
Thank you for your public comment.
Thank you for your public comment. Do we have other public comments online?
We do. Kyle Griffith, you may begin your public comment. Kyle?
Good evening, folks. My name is Kyle Griffith. I'm here presenting on behalf of Californians for Water Security. We're a broad statewide coalition of labor, business, local governments, social justice, and community organizations, strongly in support of the Delta Conveyance Project. We submitted our letter that was signed by nearly 40 organizations in support of the DCP because it is an essential climate adaptation strategy for the state of California. As mentioned earlier in the presentation, nearly two-thirds of California residents rely on water through the State Water Project, but fully understand that this project is aging and in dire need of upgrades to protect future supplies against the challenges associated with climate change. We've heard time and time again that, you know, we need to take action now in order to address the impacts of climate change, and the Delta Conveyance Project is going to be part of how we respond to the threat of diminishing water supplies. We know that nearly 10% of our water is going to be lost to evaporation in the future, and the shifting hydrology is not prepared for the boom and bust precipitation cycle that we are experiencing. You know, we're in the middle of another rainstorm here, and we lack the adequate conveyance in order to capture this water to save it for when we know the next drought will be coming. I would also like to push back against Ms. Wagner's, comments about the state of California not wanting this project. That is patently false. In summer of last year, our coalition conducted public research polling on the project, and across all regions, all political parties and major demographics, the Delta Conveyance Project is supported, including 80% in Southern California, 73% in the Bay Area, et cetera, et cetera. We know the state of California knows that this is an essential project and fully support modernizing our infrastructure in order to support continued prosperity in the state. We are eager to work with your board and the other water agencies that are considering the project and are looking forward to its completion. Thank you.
Thank you for your public comment. We do have more public comment.
Continue on.
Charming Evelyn, you may begin your public comment. Charming Evelyn, there we go. You may begin your public comment.
Yes, thank you. There is a delay when the host asks you to unmute. My name is Charming Evelyn, and I am the chair of the Water Committee. And I am speaking today, of course, on behalf of many people. The last speaker spoke about a survey. Guess what? We also conducted a poll and a survey, and no one wanted the Delta. No one wanted this conveyance. So I think it really depends on how you ask the question and, you know, how you explain what the Delta conveyance is to people, because you can manufacture whatever answer that you'd like, especially if you're a proponent of the program. However, this evening, I really would like to touch on the fact that this is always billed as a big gulp, little sip. This is not a big gulp, little sip. And I really dislike DWR and others when they say, oh, in wet years, we can capture more water in the north diversion and it will help. You know what? That did not help. With the drought we had the last time, we had no salmon fishing, the Delta smelt is gone, and all of that is because we have removed too much water from the system. We need the excess flows from the storms to actually move silt into the area and to provide cooling ponds so that the fish could actually lay their eggs, and maybe the Delta smelt will come back. And it is really disingenuous when I hear folks speak about this and they actually do not mention the ecology and the biology and the marine life that depend on freshwater flows flowing through the Delta. It is terribly unfair not to mention that. Do not blame the fish to say that you need an additional diversion because there are too many fish within the southern area of the Delta. Again, that is unfair. You have the tribes that depend on fisheries. You have folks in the Delta that depend on the Delta for recreation. And you have other folks from EJ communities that depend on the Delta. And Charlie Wilson, who spoke earlier, is a colleague of mine. And I disagree with Charlie when it comes to public participation with DWR. Katie said exactly what occurred with the tribes. And if there was anyone from the tribal communities here this evening, they will tell you that DWR has not been a willing partner. And I urge everyone to think, would you want anyone to go up and dig up the remains of your family? Would you want anyone to do that to you? This is one of the proposals that's going to happen with this Delta. And saying that you're going to have community benefits as mitigation does not wash. It is completely unfair. And there we are harming the tribes. We continuously harm tribal communities.
Thank you so much for your public comment, but that does conclude your public comment.
Thank you.
Mr. Mars, you may begin your public comment.
Hello?
Can you hear me? Yes, we can.
Yes, my name is Lionel Mars. I'm a resident of the San Fernando Valley, and I'm calling to express my disappointment with the state Department of Water Resources because he did not allow public comment period on the Delta Tunnel Environmental Impact Report last month. And I'm very concerned about the project. Unintended consequence of this project it will have on the fish, the natural river, the habitat, and I urge you not to support the Delta Covenant project or Sites Reservoir. These projects will further harm the Bay Delta, which is already facing harmful algae blooms, fish kills, saltwater intrusion, and declining salmon population thanks to the reduced freshwater flows in the Delta. This is the eighth year in a row that the Delta smelt were found in the Bay Delta. Construction wouldn't even start until the end of this decade and would take a minimum of 16 years to build. These are expensive projects and they may become stranded assets. Don't waste our taxpayer money on these projects. that will do more harm than good. There are other ways of conserving, capturing stormwater while at the same time protecting our natural habitat environment and endangered species, because we're facing a historic climate change due to human-caused climate, methane, fossil fuels, and it's hurting our environment. And we must do what we can to protect. And there are better methods of stormwater capture. And I urge you not to continue with these two projects. Thank you. I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you for your public comment. And that does conclude public comment.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Let me ask you a question. One of the commenters referred to the letter that I think was provided, we received online. Is that correct?
There was somebody who did want to make public comment. I believe that they already did.
Okay, so the letter that you have in front of you, and I believe this will be part of the minutes of the meeting?
It'll be included. The public comment was received.
Okay, yeah. Very good. So I don't know that I need to go through this letter. It was already presented mostly. So, but I would ask Ms. Buckner and Mr. Bradner, I'm not expecting you or asking you to comment on every public comment that was made, but I would simply ask, listening to the range of public comments that you just heard, I'm assuming that those comments and those questions and those points were raised in the review of the environmental document and have already been responded to. Is that correct?
Yes, President Martin. So I think one note is that we did hear a number of people expressing concerns about commenting on the final EIR. Someone mentioned we didn't accept comments on the EIR, and I think just to be clear, that was referring to the final. Generally, CEQA doesn't identify a comment period on the final EIR. The idea is that the comments are on the draft. We address those comments, we make revisions, and that is the final. And so that's why we did structure the process as we did. And I think a lot of the comments that we heard were focused on a lot of concerns about the state of environmental resources, including fish and water quality. And a lot of those are really concerns focused on existing conditions, the conditions that are there now. A lot of the impact analysis that we're looking at is how that could change with Delta conveyance. And so I think we just want to sort of separate those two things. I think we have many concerns about the status of, for example, Delta smelt. The Delta conveyance project did identify the potential for significant impacts, but mostly that was because of the imperiled status, because it is such an extremely endangered species. The effect that we would have would be pretty minor, and we're working very hard to mitigate that. So the types of things that were discussed by the commenters tonight were included in the EIR and assessed in detail.
Thank you, Ms. Buckman. I think that concludes public comment. Is that correct, April?
Yes, it does.
We can now open up to questions and discussion from the board. Director Colley.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit troubled by the comments, because the comments that were apparently against both sites in this project that we're discussing tonight, only the last commenter made any reference to alternatives, and he didn't provide any specifics, and so I don't know what specifics he's thinking of. But I guess what occurs to me is that if we as mankind collectively, or all of Californians collectively, decided we just didn't give a damn about the environment, and we didn't care about fish and we didn't care about anything, we just wanted water, we don't need this. There's plenty of capacity through the Delta that we could just pump water through the Delta and be done with it. And we'd save ourselves billions of dollars in doing so. As I understand it, if I can oversimplify this a little bit, is that this is an attempt to do the least environmental harm and gain back the water that we would have had available to us were we not to care about the environment at all. Is that grossly inaccurate, or is that, I mean, it's too much a simplification, but that's at least.
So I think I would be a little hesitant with the idea that we're trying to gain back water if we weren't concerned about environmental constraints. So I will say the regulatory environment that we function in as the state of California includes a lot of protections. Some of the key protections include the Delta Water Quality Control Plan, which protects for beneficial uses in the Delta. And that includes a lot of water quality and flow standards that we have to meet. And then the California and Federal State Endangered, California and Federal Endangered Species Acts, which include a lot of provisions to avoid effects to endangered species. And any effects under the California Endangered Species Act have to be fully mitigated. So we can't, we cannot have sort of a small increment that's left that people think is okay. You have to fully mitigate. So I think what I want to say there is we are in a regulatory environment that identifies the importance of the environment and the many benefits that it creates to society as a whole. I think when we're looking at the purpose of this project, we're not necessarily trying to regain the State Water Project as it used to operate, perhaps before some of those regulations took effect. I think what we're trying to do right now is maintain the stability of the project moving forward, looking at climate change, understanding the risks that are coming at us with climate change, sea level rise, earthquakes, trying to make sure that we don't continue to have this decline in the amount of water the State Water Project can provide into the future.
If I could.
By all means, please.
I would just offer from an engineering perspective, we did, you know, as Carrie mentioned, with our early efforts to conceive this single tunnel project from the ground up. We thought about it from the initial siting of all the various facilities, performed completely new siting studies for all those elements, took a lot of input from our stakeholder engagement committee through that process, sought to create a project concept that minimized the impacts before the evaluations through the EIR, which would then identify mitigations. There are many different ways to build this project, many of which would be much more impactful than the project selected by the department. Yes, the tunnel is longer because it skirts around the eastern edges of the margin and then connects with the facilities in the South Delta. Cutting a straight line across the Central Delta would make for a shorter tunnel, would certainly save tunnel costs, but would increase risk to the environment, would increase risk to the existing levees that exist within that Central Delta. Would create significant challenges, unpredictable challenges, adding risk to completion of the project. The fact that we can construct the entire 45 miles from only two tunnel launch shafts is a completely new concept introduced with this project. So I think there are numerous built-in minimizations of those issues and creating a project that we do think strikes the best balance possible. Yes, there will be construction effects during completion of this project if it does carry on, but I think we put the project into the best possible position.
Very much appreciate your comments. I would just suggest to folks that are commenting on this, I heard one person suggest that every tribe would prefer no project at all. Heard another commenter say that there was other ways around this. It's more useful to me for people to provide, to tell me that we recognize a need for water. People drink water, use water for a variety of things, and it's more useful to me if people would suggest a way that I can get that water to the people that need it. Rather than just say, I don't like this project, I think you should not do anything, because I'm not sure that doing nothing is a good idea. I think it's frankly kind of a bad idea. So any commenter in the future that would want to help me as an elected official, I would encourage them to tell me how they would like any elected official to pursue this need. Rather than just say, I don't like it. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So as a useful public comment, I just encourage folks to to tell me or elected officials what they would like to have happen. So thank you.
All right. Looking left. Vice President Goodside.
Thank you. Just a couple questions. We had the history at the beginning. I was struck by the massive size and depth of this tunnel when Graham was talking, which, you know, people are going to say, well, that's cost, right? Huge tunnel, very deep, very thick, very big. What did we gain by switching from the peripheral canal design to the tunnel design? That's question one. And then question two, heard a lot about reaching out to the people in the Delta that may feel the impact of construction, but not necessarily see a water gain from the Delta, from the construction. Is there going to be any outreach to the rest of the state, to Southern California, who might want to know why are we going to have to pay for this? Maybe to Northern California, who might want to know why do we even care? It's south of us. Is there going to be other outreach? So that's question two.
Okay. So I think I can start maybe on the first question, and then Graham, if you want to add anything. I think sort of in the really big picture, when you look at sort of the peripheral canal to California water fix to Delta conveyance, there have been some really, really key differences that have been made to try to reduce the environmental effects of the project. So the peripheral canal is an above ground canal, had some really significant environmental impacts. I mean, from a wildlife perspective, it's a major barrier to movement. It had a pretty large land use footprint. And for the residents and the people who live in the Delta, that was pretty concerning. And so I think that that was a really major step to move it underground to avoid those kinds of effects. And then I think from California Water Fix to Delta conveyance, we've really tried to further that, to really do everything we can to try to reduce those effects. And I think that really one of the key things that was done this time, as Graham mentioned, is moving the project towards I-5. And what we really realized as we look into the environmental effects is a lot of the impacts, particularly to the Delta communities, are driven by access to the surface sites, right? Like having a tunnel go under the property really doesn't cause a concern at the surface. What causes a concern is the areas where we are constructing at the surface. So trying to site those near major transportation corridors so there really isn't that same level of activity within the Delta, those kinds of changes made a really big difference in terms of the types of effects that we're looking at. Graham, do you want to add anything before I second?
I mean, I think all I could add at this point would be relatively minor, because I think those are the really large points. But just thinking more specifically about the project configuration, having the major work activities associated with launching the tunnel boring machines at just two locations, those are major hubs of activity. So that's where the vast majority of the construction activity is occurring. Setting aside the intakes in the north and the new pumping plant in the south, everything in between is just associated with construction of the tunnel. What's needed for the tunnel versus a surface grading operation, in this case, you're able to really consolidate those activities to those launch sites. Everything else happens below ground, so all of the excavated material comes back to those launch sites and is brought to the surface and managed. All of the tunnel segments that are being cast off-site are brought to those launch sites and lowered down the shaft and conveyed out to the head of the machine. So it really prevents it from being sort of a uniform construction operation across the entire alignment to more of an effort that's concentrated at those launch locations and then generally occurring below ground. I mean, I think there are a number of engineering advantages being down in those more consolidated deposits as opposed to on the surface, where there could be loose, more compressible materials, although the peripheral canal alignment did have an alignment that tried to skirt around the eastern edge as well to avoid some of those issues. But I think I'll just leave it there.
And the question about outreach, we have been doing some outreach in the areas that would receive water from the project. It is, I'd say, maybe a lower intensity than the outreach that we've been doing in the Delta, but we are planning to continue and ramp up as we move forward. So we've been primarily working with the state water contractor agencies as a way that we recognize that the agencies who are living and working in these communities are the ones who are most knowledgeable. So we have been working with each agency to really identify the best ways to reach their constituents as well as other people within their areas.
Vice President Ozahosky.
Mr. Radner and Ms. Buckman, thank you for flying in and giving us this update in person. Definitely appreciate these regular updates. Two questions. One kind of specific, since Mr. Bradner, you're here. You mentioned that the shaft sites will be used for mitigate major surge events. Can you briefly talk about that? What do you mean by that? What is a surge event?
Sure. So the most extreme condition would occur under full flow operation. So if the system were diverting 6,000 cubic feet per second, and then there were a power outage, for instance, that shut down operations. So you'd have an instantaneous stop of the pump on the downstream end. So you have that water that's moving through the tunnel at a rate of about 6 or 7 feet per second. And that's the surge, that is the surge wave. And so that train would rack back and forth through the tunnel without managing surge. It can be very damaging, but the way you manage surge is through the surge basin that's on the south end of the project. So that provides a spillover area for that surge wave to spill out into the basin and stay contained and then be released back into the tunnel. The volume within the shafts themselves also help to mitigate surge. They provide a high spot for that water to rise up and gradually recede back down. And that's the process that needs to happen to slowly get control of the surge issue. Without it, it just continues to go up and down, up and down the tunnel alignment within the tunnel.
Okay, understood. Thank you. Yeah. And Madam Secretary, can you pull up, I believe, the second to last slide showing the timeline of what's going to happen in 2024?
Sorry, Director, I'll add too that the shaft heights themselves are elevated for multiple reasons. And that elevated shaft height essentially is a stovepipe that helps to manage the surge.
Okay, yeah. Understood. Thank you.
Is that showing?
Yeah. I believe it's...
Do you remember what slide it is?
Second to last, I believe.
Second to last.
There we go. That's it. Ms. Buckman, so this is the milestone in 2024. how can our agency and any other agencies that are participants help you in either moving things along or help with assessments, with submittals? What can we do to not necessarily expedite, because everything has a time stop here, but assist in making this go forward?
So we do work really closely with the state water contractors as we're doing this environmental compliance process. So we have worked with the agency staff and a lot of the deliverables, making sure that we're characterizing things correctly, getting advice and input as we move forward. And I think that that's critical to continue so that we are making sure that we use all the information available. Additionally, I think that there is going to be a process this year, and Matt and Steve can probably answer this better, to talk about continued participation, not in implementation, we're not there yet, but the next phase of the project. And I don't know if you want to talk more about that.
Yeah, I was going to wait till the end, but I will segue because it's pertinent, I think. I think, as I mentioned in the GM report at the last meeting, and I was going to kind of close with that tonight, but I'll go ahead and get to that, is, next for us as an agency, we provided a 4-year funding commitment in, I think, 2020, and there's still funding in use from that commitment. We're just one share of that from the other participating contractors. But we are working with DWR and the Conveyance Authority to look at those needs to take the project forward another few years in the permitting and preliminary design process. So we should anticipate having something ready to discuss with the board. And tonight's presentation was to try to start that, process of just informing the board about the project and the current status. And then we'll be bringing back an item hopefully this spring with a request for our share of that next batch of interim funding. It might be a little further out, just kind of depends on how everything comes together with estimates. Just reiterating again, for our agency, we have collected money on the state water specific property tax. We have a fairly healthy reserve there in place, in part because we were starting to try to anticipate having funds on hand for the project, and then it encountered a little bit of a slowdown in the reconfiguration to the single tunnel project over the last several years. I think we should be in pretty good shape to fund that next tranche without need to even adjust the specific tax rate at this point in time. But we'll have a better analysis of that once we see what that figure is. And that's not, but reiterate, it's not on the agenda for action tonight. So just giving you kind of a process description of what would be coming back for the board in a future notice public meeting.
Understood. Thank you, Mr. Stone. Thank you, Mr. Buckman and Mr. Bradner. Looking forward to the updated cost estimate and the preferred project engineers report. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you, Vice President Ozofsky. I'm looking at, Director Armitage.
Just real quickly, I just wanted to thank Ms. Buckman and Mr. Bradner for your presentation today. And I also want to thank the members of the public who took the time to call in and make public comment. I just have to say it's really refreshing to have this robust of a discussion, including public comment, and this much engagement. So it's really nice to hear. Thank you.
Director Cooper.
Thank you, President Martin, and thank you both for coming down. I've been to your presentations before, and they're always very informative of what's going on. And I think Matt kind of answered. I have two questions. One of them is kind of what's the drop dead time for agencies to show their participation this year? I guess if somebody is going to drop out, this will be the year that they drop out if they don't help fund the continuation of this. Is that correct?
So I do think that this year is a step in terms of moving forward and making sure that the group is still participating and in it together, for lack of a better way to put it. I think in terms of when this year is the drop dead date, I don't know that I have an exact answer to that. I think we're still trying to work out that process, but it will be this year.
It'll be this year.
Yeah.
Okay. And I absolutely support this project. I think this is for the state of California as a whole. This is vitally important to the economy of the state in the future. I think it's absolutely necessary. What happens to the project if MWD or Kern County back out?
I don't think we've given that much thought to that. I think that we're really focusing on...
And you too, you've given a lot of thought.
Well, I think that the project... The strength of the project is bringing the entities forward together. So I think what we're mostly looking at is how to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the different agencies, working to try to keep that in the front of our mind, and considering that as we're doing the next phase of the analysis. So I'd say that that's sort of looking at it from the other perspective, which is making sure that the agency needs are met as we're going through this planning and permitting process. But I don't know if others have a better answer to that one.
Yeah, I was going to try to get you off the hook, but I wasn't fast enough. Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the elephant in the room question as far as Metropolitan. I'm not so sure with respect to Kern.
Yeah, that's kind of iffy.
As whether that would, you know, significantly alter course. You know, thus far, I think Metropolitan's going through its own process, and I'll speak to that a little bit in my GM report comments as well tonight. But I think they're going through a process of assessing the project, the costs, the timing. One of the things they've emphasized is they really want to make sure that the project can be built if they're going to make the commitment. So they're kind of pushing in the other direction on how do we get bona fide commitments for the project from a permitting standpoint, in addition to their decision on funding. So I know that they're going through a climate adaptation master plan. They're also doing financial planning, much like we've done recently, looking at our CIP. And they have a little different set of parameters. All their customers are other public agencies. They have no retail customers. So that's kind of a little bit of a different dialogue. I worked in that world for 14 years. I know how fun it is, but I also know that that collective group has managed over the years to confront daunting financial and project decisions and emerge with, you know, new perspective and new adaptations. I think obviously if they dropped out of the project, it goes without saying we're in a regrouping mode. I think all the other participating agencies would have to really take a look at what is the project without, you know, Metropolitan in it. At this point, we don't have direct control over that. I think at this stage, we're trying to look at, you know, similar to sites. If half of the participants in sites suddenly dropped out, we'd have to reassess, you know, what's there and what would our share be, and is that a good cost benefit or not? So I think that question would remain to be answered once it's asked, I guess, if it actually happens. For now, I think our pressing question this year will be continuing to fund our, you know, 2.5-3% of the project and moving it forward further so we can hopefully get to a decision point.
Well, yeah, in talking to directors from Met, even those that are in support of it, the chairman of the board doesn't appear to be in support of it. It's and they're spending a lot of money on the Pure Water project, and they don't know if they have money for this project. So I guess that has me a little concerned, whether we don't want to throw good money after bad. If Met's going to back out of this thing, we're all in trouble. Just a thought.
Director Brownstein.
Good evening, and sorry. Thank you so much for the both of you for coming down here and doing this in person. This is really special. And I'd love to echo Director Armitage's thanking people for calling in, because I really wish more people called in more often, because this is, I'm sure it's not fun all the time to hear all the comments, but this is how we grow and we learn and we can make better decisions. So I love it. So I'm new to water. So you're just going to have to bear with me. I might ask questions that you're going to laugh at, but here it goes. So first of all, for funding, the state water project, why is this not like a bond or a water, you know, like some kind of state funding to help everybody get water? And so that's my...
Yeah, in general, and there are some exceptions to this general rule, but the general rule has been that the practice has been for the participating agencies through state contract to commit to a share of the cost for their area, and then they recover that revenue. The original project was funded from voter authorized bonds, and that's why we have a tax increment in our area that helps pay for that. Some areas have opted to not collect that and put it all on their water sales or rates costs. So each area kind of has their own funding mechanism locally, and there hasn't been like a general obligation bond, other than perhaps some ancillary activity. I think we were looking at maybe some subsidence mitigation that might have come up in state funding, although right now I'm not sure it will be anything in state funding for a little while.
That's
like kind of iron the current deficit out. But for the most part, that's been the tradition of the State Water Project, is the contracting agencies, which is a pretty significant chunk of the total population. So if you look at it that way, it is still a, you know, 28 million people are helping to shoulder the cost of that if they're all in.
Yeah. So I'm just hoping that we can reach maybe more people that might need, like,
right,
you know, kind of thing, with wells drying up and all that fun kind of stuff. Just a thought kind of thing. So I find it disturbing, and I hope that it's not true, that we're actually expecting people to move burial sites, because that seems kind of harsh to a group of people that we've already exploited and done a lot of things to.
So I hope that that's not exactly, but I was wondering if any of the tribes commented on the EIR, the draft EIR, or and how that went.
So when we've gone through tribal consultation, one of the challenging elements of looking at tribal resources is that the exact locations aren't known. So as we look at the sites, there are things where we know there could be a conflict, and we've looked at whether we can work around it and avoid that conflict. But even then, we've had to recognize that the boundaries that are established in the historical record may not be right. It might not show the full extent. It might not be accurate. Some of these are quite old and don't necessarily reflect actual locations. So we've definitely laid out a plan for what we would do. So first, we avoid where we can. We survey and more solidly identify sites. We avoid wherever possible, where we can avoid it and still meet the objective of a site. And if we can't, then we do have to relocate, but we would do that in consultation with the tribes, following a very clearly laid out procedure that we establish with the tribes. And I'd say that that process is pretty similar to other large infrastructure. That's generally the kind of process we go through. Avoidance is absolutely the preferred method and what we will try for first. But again, we don't entirely know where the sites are, so we can't fully commit to being able to avoid everything. So that's the process we would follow. Tribes did submit comments, and as the speaker mentioned, and as we put in the EIR, the tribes do not support the project. I fully understand that. The Delta is a very important region to the tribes, and this project doesn't benefit the tribes, so there really isn't much of a reason to support it. But we are working very closely with them, and they have generously participated in many meetings, and they put a lot of their time and energy in to try to help reduce the effects of this project in meaningful and important ways, even through the process when they do not agree with the end project. So they've really been tremendously helpful, even with that disagreement.
And a follow-up would be, you spoke about the community benefit mitigation and leave behind. I'm wondering, it might just be something that's established later on down the line. You're putting out expectations out there, I guess, when you're promising these kind of benefits. How confident are you that you're actually, that people won't be disappointed with these expectations that you're putting out there for mitigations and benefits?
That is a really good question. And I think that's some of what we're going to be trying to work through this year as we refine the framework. You know, I think that there's sort of a constant balancing act in this kind of funding effort where we want to make sure that we are giving as much of the funding as possible to the public entities or the local entities that want to implement projects. But we also want to make sure we have some monitoring and making sure that things are going well and provide technical support where we can and where it's needed. So there's sort of there's sometimes a push and pull between monitoring and making sure things work out the way we want them to, or that the local agencies do, and making sure that the local entities get as much funding as possible. So we're going to be getting input on that this summer.
Okay. And then, sorry, I have a few more. my other question was, thinking outside of the box, because I think the biggest problem that a lot of us have is that, for example, like with DSAL, right? We're looking at it as this could be another horrible disaster 50 years from now. How do we make sure that we're not creating another bad situation, right? So everybody's like really nervous about, and rightfully so, and hesitating about jumping into doing something like that. What kind of out of the box thinking and have you guys been encountering? What different fields have you been bringing in? Maybe like a think tank, like, I don't know, bringing, I know it's going to sound weird, but like occupational therapist or biologist, just a physiologist, to look at this in a different way as an organism or ecosystem, you know?
Yeah. So I think I was looking at Graham because I think my initial thought was to think back to the stakeholder engagement committee that we worked with. And I wouldn't say that it necessarily went towards some of the specifics that you're looking at, but we did have a pretty broad group of local representatives that talked about the project, and they came from a really diverse cross section of the community. I think that in general, that really is part of the reason for the EIR, to try to lay out the potential impacts, solicit feedback and respond, and so really try to consider those things. And that is part of the reason too that we tried to reach people in so many different ways. So one of the things that we did with the like farmers markets when we set up a table is we have like a kid table where the kids can go and color and be entertained while we talk to the adults. And again, like, I guess what I'm saying there is we really want to try to reach people through non-traditional means as a way to try to make sure that people are hearing about the project and we're receiving their feedback. So I think those are a few ways. I don't know, Graham, if you have any other ideas.
I guess it's sort of a little bit difficult for me because we're a design and construction entity. And so the out of the box thinking that we do is confined to designing a facility with a certain set of parameters and a certain set of goals, which is somewhat confining, I suppose. But that is our mission. But we do hold regular independent reviews. We bring in various professionals in a range of professions that would be relevant for a given topic. They don't tend to all be with one particular background. They have a pretty broad cross section, but it all does tend to have a relationship with whatever feature or concept we might be reviewing. Those processes are common in our industry. Certainly on a project of this scale and magnitude are incredibly important to get diversity in terms of perspective and concepts, and we do look for innovations. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity there. But for me, it's all built within the engineering and construction industry.
Okay. I mean, there's innovation there too, but I would hope.
Yep.
Okay. So lastly, it's something that I personally think that our agency does really well, is that we will beat a horse to death here in trying to make sure that our customers are happy. We will go out over and over and talk to people, and they go out of their way to make sure that everybody feels heard. And I really hope that you guys are still accepting comments, even though the EIR is closed, but that you're still accepting comments and listening to people, because if you really want everybody to feel like this is something that they want to be a part of, you have to make sure that people feel heard and respected. And it's just troubling. I mean, listen, I understand that there's people that won't be happy with it, and they serve a purpose too, right? Because they are the little fire under our butts that make us, you know, make sure that we don't mess up, right? They make us check things twice, three times, four times. And I think that helps us get the best result in the end. So I think all these people, they have their place and they have their purpose. And I really hope that you embrace that and try to make people feel like they're going to be a part of this too.
I appreciate that. And public outreach and engagement is a critical component of all the work we're doing. I always want to talk about it in public settings because I want people to understand that we really prioritize that. I want to be careful that we can't take comments on the EIR anymore because it is finished. And so I always want to be careful that when we do engage with the community, we're sort of clear on the boundaries, because it's really frustrating, I think, for people to come and think that they're able to change a document that is complete at this point. That said, there is so much more opportunity where we can hear and understand and better communicate with people. We do not want to limit that at all. And we're definitely still interested in hearing and engaging with people.
From the DCA perspective, we do have an advantage. You know, I described in my last comment sort of about maybe some of the confines that we live within, but we do have a lot of freedom and flexibility. We have one mission in this world, and that is to deliver this project, but to do it in a way that's transparent. The stakeholder engagement committee that was mentioned earlier was a big a huge effort for us, an incredibly valuable effort for us. There were a lot of participants, none or many of whom did not support the project, but recognized the opportunity to be in the room with us as we try and sort out how the project could be configured, how the various alternatives could be configured, how we could evolve and iterate the project to a better condition. So that was an incredibly valuable process that I really look back on, and I'm grateful that the DCA board requested that and required that committee of us. I do envision that there will be more of those types of opportunities for public engagement during the design process and then construction. We do intend to have community groups that can help us as we take those designs and move them into the final design phase to take their input in terms of site configurations and layouts and aesthetics and a number of other ways that really valuable input could be brought in from those who live in the community. That's definitely part of our program and is a commitment that we made when we sunsetted the stakeholder engagement committee, was to continue that engagement. We're not there yet, but we will be, and we absolutely will be following through with that commitment. And then continuing through the same efforts of transparency and accountability through construction, making sure that everyone that could encounter our equipment or facilities or people out in the world of the Delta know exactly who they can reach out to and talk to if they have an issue or concern, if they have feedback. We want to make that a very easy process. We want to make it an easy process for folks to come talk about their legitimate concerns and have a way to communicate that to us directly. So all of that is built into our approach, and we'll absolutely be taking that forward.
Yeah, I acknowledge that you guys are both very passionate about this, and your hearts are both in the right place. Like, you are trying to really just help. I get it. You know, it's not anything personal. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Director Bronstein. Director Peterson, did you want to have any comment or question before we move over to one more director that hasn't had a chance to talk on this side?
Marks haven't either. I kind of enjoy this, considering I reflect back to the peripheral canal days. But it was quite a project then, and now this project is quite a project you guys are involved with now out there. And you have my support, that's for sure.
Thank you, Director Peterson. Director Marks, did you want to comment?
Oh, only to thank Graham and Gary for coming here tonight and providing a great presentation, as well as sharing some of your responses to the public concerns that come up tonight. Been very informative and very appreciated. Thank you.
Right. I think that concludes our board comments and discussion. I want to thank you both for coming down to talk with us. A very important project for our board to understand and to hear more about. So with that, we'll just say thank you and move on to the next item. Thank you both. All right, we've exceeded our 30-minute budget for that presentation. So we can move to item 6, consent calendar. There are 8 items on the consent calendar tonight. And by the way, we didn't have this long presentation to encourage us to make a motion and vote on the consent calendar right away, but that's your choice. There were revised resolutions for item 6.3, which was changing the recital 6 to say public meeting instead of public hearing. Item 6.4, which was changing the recital 10 to say public meeting instead of public hearing. And item 6.8, correcting the signature page. Revised resolutions were emailed, posted on the website, and are at each of our spots at the board here. There were no other changes to the resolutions. Before I ask for a board motion, are there any public comment on the consent calendar items?
There is not.
Very good. Then I would, Dr. Brownstein.
I'd like to pull 6.4. And I also have a small comment on this consent calendar, if I can.
Okay, so you want a presentation on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I'd like a presentation on 6.4.
All right, then any motion for approval of consent calendar with item 6.4 pulled? We have a motion by Director Marks for approval of the consent calendar with item 6.4 removed and pulled for separate discussions. Is there a second? Director Cooper seconded. Any other discussion or comment from the board?
Well, I had a comment in general that I wanted to say about the consent calendar.
Yes.
It was ridiculous.
Well.
I once again would like to put out there that I think the planning needs to be a little bit more proactive, because it's ridiculous to have such a large consent calendar with a lot of money on it, like a lot of millions of dollars. And since, I mean, and I know I'm the only one here, but I'm the only one here that's in a committee that never has any agenda items. So I always have to do a lot of extra reading. And I would request that this doesn't happen again.
Comment noted, Director Bronstein. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Colley.
Yes.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Director Bronstein.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Vice President Gutzeit.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass, and that includes resolution numbers SCV-398, SCV-400, SCV-401, SCV-402, SCV-403, and SCV-404.
Can I make a comment? I should have commented earlier, but just as far as items coming to the board from committees, I came from a very small agency, which actually rarely had committee meetings. So that was a different structure. But this is a very large agency with some very complex things. And I want to say I trust that items that come to the board have gone through committee thoroughly and have, at least for the finance committee, if it's unanimous, it'll go to consent, or we may recommend it go to consent. But if there's any controversy, we don't suggest it go to consent. So I just want to say that another viewpoint is that the committees are doing the heavy lift, and we don't have to repeat the work that the committee is doing all the time, unless there's some controversy coming out of that committee. So that's my opinion on why we may do consent here more often than a smaller agency that doesn't have robust committee activity.
Okay, noted. So it was 6.4 that you want a presentation, right? Mr. Stone, if you want Mr. Mayo to make a brief presentation.
Looks like he's here. Keep him on his toes.
I actually was pre-warned that this was going to get pulled. So our principal engineer, Jason Yim, is online, and he'll actually do the presentation for you today, and then I'll be available for questions. Jason, are you available? Hopefully. Maybe not. Maybe I will get to do the presentation after all.
Hello.
There he is.
I just got promoted to panelist here. So I just need a quick second. There we go. Okay. Good evening, President Martin and members of the board. So I'll be presenting this item. I just need to get my screen here. Yeah. Anyways, I'm Jason Yim, principal engineer with the agency, and I'll be presenting this item to approve a resolution adopting the final mitigated negative declaration and mitigation monitoring and reporting program and approve a purchase order for final design services for the Hanbi Tank Pipeline Project. Next slide, please. There we go. So this slide shows SCV Water service area on the left with the project location shown approximately in the middle as a red star. On the right of the slide, it shows the aerial image of the project with the two existing Hanbi tanks on the top part of the map there and the existing pipeline that runs down that drawing along with the proposed 24-inch pipeline. So during planning, the existing pipeline that feeds these two Hanbi tanks was determined to be too small and is considered a hydraulic bottleneck in our distribution system. So it was determined that a 24-inch pipeline would be needed at this location. So as such, this project generally consists of the installation of a 24-inch pipeline, which is shown as the solid dark blue line parallel to the existing pipeline that's dashed from the existing Hanbi tanks on the top of the hill to the distribution system at the intersection of Santa Clara Street and Hanbi Avenue. Next slide, please. So in regards to the CEQA evaluation of the project, the initial study mitigated negative declaration document was prepared and circulated for public review for 30 days from September 21st to October 23rd. We have received two comment letters from the review process, one letter from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the other second letter from the California Department of Transportation. So we have responded to their comments, and the comment and response letters are included in Appendix E of the MND, which is the mitigated negative declaration document, which is in your board packet. Next slide, please. So this table shows the California Department of Fish and Wildlife comments along with our responses and revisions. So their first comment was on the potential impact to the habitat supporting the arroyo toad and western spadefoot. So as a result, the mitigation measures were revised to include focused surveys for those species and preparation of a protection plan, along with requiring the biological monitor to hold the appropriate permits for species capture and hunting. Their second comment was related to impacts on special status plant species. And as a result, the replacement ratios in the mitigation measures were revised. The third comment recommended increasing the avoidance buffer for the nesting birds and the raptors. So the response indicated there, you can see in the bottom right corner of that table, there'll be no revision to the mitigation measures since the mitigation measures already requires a pre-construction nesting bird surveys, and the proposed buffers are expected to be sufficient given the project's narrow footprint, constructability methods, and similar mitigation measures implemented on other projects. So you can see on this table, basically, those are the three main comments we received from Fish and Wildlife and how we address or revise the mitigation measures in response to their comments. Next slide, please. So this table here basically shows the categories that have potential environmental concern. So that's that first column you see there. So it has air quality, biological resources, cultural resources, hazards and hazardous materials, hydrology and water quality, transportation, tribal cultural resources, wildfire, and mandatory findings of significance. And with the proposed mitigation measures that's identified in the second column, those are the various measures you can see, AQ1, Bio1, and so on. Those reference the mitigation measures in the document. So with those measures being implemented, the impacts are reduced to less than significant. And the comment letter that we did get from the Department of Transportation basically commented on the requirements for traffic control plans and a hazardous materials management and spill control plan, which will be prepared during the design phase. The anticipated traffic counts generated from the construction activities are not anticipated to substantially contribute to congestion on Caltrans roadways. Next slide, please. So with the planning phase being completed and the CEQA documents in place, the next step after adopting the MND and MMRP would be final design. So staff has completed the standard process of soliciting and evaluating design proposals using Planet Bids. One proposal was received from Kennedy Jenks Consultants, which is the same company that did the planning work. The final design fee is $370,000, and work would be performed on a time and material basis. The CIP budget for this fiscal year is $400,000, so there are adequate funds to perform the work. Next slide, please. This design scope of work generally includes site visits, existing data reviews, surveying, geotechnical investigation, and preparing the construction drawings, specifications, and construction cost estimates, along with attending various meetings. Next slide, please. So this is the schedule for the project. If approved tonight, then final design will start by February and is anticipated to be completed around July 2024. This project meets SCV Water's strategic plan objectives, B1.1.1, implement capital projects related to infrastructure reliability, and B2.1, update and carry out capital projects related to the water system reliability and sustainability. Next slide, please. So this item was presented at the January 4th Engineering and Operations Committee. And the recommendation for this item is the Engineering and Operations Committee recommends that the Board of Directors adopt a resolution approving the Hanwi Tank Pipeline Improvements Project Initial Study, Mitigated Negative Declaration, Mitigation Monitoring Reporting Program, and authorize a purchase order to Kennedy Jenks Consultants for an amount not to exceed $370,000 for final design services for the Hanwi Tank Pipeline Improvement Project. So this concludes my presentation, and I'd like to mention that we should also have in attendance Eileen Mahoney with RINCON, who helped assist with the CEQA portion in case there are CEQA-related questions. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you for your presentation. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comments on this item?
We do. Just one moment.
We do not?
No, we do.
We do. I thought
that's what you said. Yeah, just one moment. Ms. Blambeck, go ahead and begin your public comment.
Whoops, having a little trouble getting the unmute button off or on. Lynn Planbeck, and I'm here speaking for Santa Clarita Organization for Planning and the Environment. And I just wanted to ask if it would be possible for you to somehow notice the local environmental and community groups that generally speak on these projects, because you know, I don't necessarily attend engineering committee meetings anymore, and there's not a way I would know about this. I know you legally noticed it in the paper, but the Los Angeles County Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors, the City Council, all have a way of noticing folks of their environmental documents, and in a way that it's people might actually see them, not in the legal notices of the Signal. So I would just ask if you would look at some way that you could do that. It would be really helpful, both for transparency and community involvement. And then my second question is, I just would like to say that when the Fish and Wildlife Department says that maybe we need a wider buffer for birds, it seems like we don't really have the technical knowledge to say that they're wrong. They're the ones with the technical knowledge. And I'm wondering if this is not that big of a deal, why we can't incorporate it anyway, just to be protective of our species. We are having so much trouble with loss of wildlife and open space. And it's because of projects like this. And even though it's minimal and needed, it doesn't help when it's cumulatively, we just have so many of them. So it's important to be as protective as possible. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Planbeck. I'll give Courtney an opportunity to respond if he so chooses.
Yeah, thank you very much. I don't know if you noticed the footprint, the footnote on the slide that we actually, there were no observable birds or invasive plants in that area. And so the, although they did request an additional buffer, we are following general practice on what we've done before and what is accepted by them and was accepted by them in our response letter to the fish and game, our fish and wildlife. But there has been no noticeable birds in that area, so the current corridor was deemed acceptable. And we can also go to the environmentalist that we have on consultant, who is our expert that we hire to give that opinion.
Thank you, Courtney. All right. If there's no further public comment, we can open up to board discussion and a possible motion.
President Martin, I believe Courtney Mayo cue the CEQA individual to give a comment regarding birds. Do we have a response on call?
Well, I think we'll
April, do you have her queued
up? Comment under consideration.
Who is the person? So is Eileen Mahoney Rincon, April?
Well, let's see. Let me see if I can find her on this list.
She has her hand up.
Oh, there she is. Okay, I'm going to move her to panelist. She should be moved over.
Or are we waiting for something?
Hi, good evening, everyone. What you said was exactly correct. When we did our field visits to the project site, no nesting birds or really suitable habitat for nesting was noticed along the alignment itself. And the project footprint is so narrow and the construction is going to be linear along that footprint. And excuse me, the buffers that we used in the mitigation have been sufficient on other projects that we've done with Santa Clarita Valley Water as well. the response memorandum was provided to CDFW and they accepted the changes without the increased buffer. So they were okay with that, not having that revision.
All right. Thank you for your response. With that, we can move on and consider a motion on the item. Director Armitage.
Thank you. I had a few questions also. So a couple of just big picture questions on the project. So why are we burying the pipe versus because the other pipe was above ground. So why are we burying it this time? And then the older pipe was explained as being, it'll be abandoned and left there. So I guess my question is why isn't it going to be removed?
Okay, good big picture questions. The buried pipes are generally better protected. They're protected against any water flow. They're protected from the environment more, rain or sunshine on the pipeline. So it's a preferable alternative to bury the pipes. For the leaving the other pipe in place, it's intended to continue to use that pipe through its useful life. So we are not abandoning the pipe until it ends its useful life. We will use both in place to gain that additional storage. And then leaving that pipe in place is also a better option, cheaper for us to do at this time, rather than digging it back up and digging back through the channel. Although that could be a decision when that pipe's useful life is expired.
Okay, thank you. And then I had a few questions about the MND document. One was I couldn't find the response to the Department of Transportation's comments. I saw the response letter to Fish and Wildlife, but I didn't see one to Department of Transportation. And maybe I missed it. It was a massive document. So, but yeah, I guess, go ahead.
The response to the Caltrans comment letter is on, it's a two-page memorandum or three-page memorandum starting on page 316 of the PDF.
Okay, thanks. For the Fish and Wildlife's comment letter, they recommended including focus surveys for western spadefoot toads in addition to the rayo toads. And I did see reference to the survey for the Arroyo Toads included in Bio 6, but there's no language that includes the Western Spadefoot Toads. Is there a reason? Can that be added?
So the survey for the Arroyo Toad is going to follow the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Protocol for that type of survey, and that will also cover the Western Spadefoot as well.
Okay, but is there any harm in just including Western Spadefoot in that language too?
I don't believe that there's a specific protocol for Western Spadefoot, and that's why we only reference the Arroyo Toad protocol.
Okay, thanks. Fish and Wildlife also recommended a meeting to identify measures to prevent access into the construction area by the toads, but I didn't see that added to the mitigation plan. I did see general language describing fencing around the open trenches and excavations under Bio 1, but it seems like Fish and Wildlife was trying to share that they may have specific strategies to offer. So is there a reason why that wasn't included?
I think Bio 1 includes what you're looking for. Can you repeat exactly what portion of the mitigation you wanted added?
It sounded like they had specific mitigation strategies specifically for the toads to share, and they were encouraging a meeting to share that information. So I don't know. I know there's general language under Bio 1, but it didn't seem like it was in the same spirit as what they offered.
Mm-hmm. So the Department of Fish and Wildlife is going to have permit approval authority, and at that time, they can specify exactly what additional measures they think are needed if they don't believe that the general best management practices from Mitigation Bio 1 are adequate.
Okay. And then the last thing I'll say is I had similar thoughts as what Ms. Planbeck shared in terms of the buffer zones, the recommendations that Fish and Wildlife was giving in terms of creating the more protective buffer zones around the nesting area. Although I do hear what you're saying about not really having a lot of nesting material in the area, but I would just always encourage following what Fish and Wildlife say about that to protect the birds. So that's it. Thank you.
Director Bronstein.
Thank you. So first of all, part of the statement that we're supposed to, resolution that we're signing tonight said that the public meeting, a public meeting was held. So I felt that it was important that we pulled this and we had opportunity for people to have a conversation about it, if they wanted to, because I think that a document like this deserves attention. So my question was, first of all, about the pipe and why are we not removing it if it's right there? But thank you for that. That makes a lot of sense. Another question I had was, I know that noise isn't really an issue there. And part of the reasons that were stated was that there was a school there and that the school's making noise. And I can't help but think about kids being distracted by the noise that these trucks are making. Is that a consideration at all? Do we think about that? I mean, I know it doesn't qualify exactly under CEQA, but I was wondering if that was a thought.
It's something we can take into consideration during the design. And ultimately, when we go to construction, we can reach out to the school and talk to them about that. It may also have to do with the timing when we're working near them and whether or not school is in session. So it's something we can take under advisement during the design. It's not something that was really under the environmental concern or part of CEQA.
Right. That's why it's not exactly CEQA, but getting better at these documents. So glad I get so many opportunities to learn more. And then my other question was, you guys were there. When did the biological survey happen? It was June. Was it in June of 2023?
I'm not sure.
Yes, that was the most recent survey.
Okay, because I just wanted to make sure that it was actually taken during nesting season. And yes, awesome. Thank you for that. And then, sorry, I had another. Okay. So then in the tribal consider, so first of all, let me pull that back a second. Really happy to see that we're going to have a biologist on hand, because we don't need somebody seeing a legless lizard and thinking it's a snake and killing it or something like that. So, so I really hope that we have a real biologist and a real training and all that. And then on the cultural, the tribal cultural considerations, I was really happy to see the mitigation that was achieved there, where we're going to have somebody from the Tetavian band there so they can make sure that nothing is disturbed. My only question was the language in the document where it says that the consultation needs to be completed before a CEQA document can be certified. And there was never like a continuation. The document made it seem like there was an initial discussion, but there wasn't a follow-up to that. So I just wanted to know if like you concluded your conversations with them and got to an agreement.
Leave that to the environmentalist.
I'm not sure if you have additional information on it, Jason. I believe that consultation may have been concluded. The mitigation measures included for tribal cultural resources were requested by the tribe.
Right. And part of our design efforts, we actually do reach out to the tribe and work with them closely. So then, you know, like our other projects, we do that as well. So that would be basically done during our design stage. That way we can at least have a little better definition of the project as well, as we design out the pipeline.
Okay, because I was just wondering, just because of the wording here in the document, was just my, you know, because it says the consultation process must be completed before a CEQA document can be updated and certified.
Well, that's because we needed to get their mitigation measures, okay. And they contributed that. So that portion of their make consultation, sure that's... but that doesn't end our consultation with them.
Okay.
Because it continues into the design phase and then ultimately into construction with monitoring.
Perfect, because that's literally the next sentence was that, and I was like, wait, did we finish, did we not finish? No, that was my last question. So I wanted to say this was actually a lovely document. Thank you very much. I learned a lot. And I was really happy to see how far our agency will go to try to make accommodations and to make sure that we really don't disturb things that we shouldn't disturb, and, you know, do a good job. So thank you.
Okay. Director Cooper.
I was going to say I'll make a motion but I see that you're you talk.
This was reviewed at the Engineering and Operations Committee, and I guess just a comment that goes along with this before I make a motion is that the committee engineering has a lot of work. There's a lot of work coming up. There's some important projects coming up. This isn't our first pipeline. We do the same thing on all pipelines. The CEQA is pretty much standard. You have a biological person out there. You go to the Indian groups. It's all pretty standard stuff that's done. The things that we put on the consent calendar are items that we consider they're all significant, but in the scheme of things, these are insignificant items. This is an item that's $370,000. It's not a large item. We had another one that's $500,000. Nothing that's over a million. When we had $1 million, we like to bring them to the board and have the board look at it. Putting some more AMI meters out there, that's a grant. That's money that we received to put the meters out. All of these items are to help speed this board meeting along. So if you need to pull something off to get some clarification on it, absolutely. But we're going to continue to put consent calendar items on the consent calendar. We're not going to cut that back. It's important that we take the small items, put them on consent. It's not the first pipeline. It's not the first time we've sandblasted a tank. It's not the first time I've done a lot of things that we've done in the past. So those will continue to come on to the consent calendar. With that, I will make a motion to approve the item.
All right, we have a motion to approve 6.4.
I'll second it.
Second by Director Bronstein. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Colley.
Yes.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Director Bronstein.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahowski.
Yes.
Vice President Gutzeit.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass, and that's resolution number 399, SCV-399.
Very good. We can move on to item 7, General Manager's Report on Activities, Projects, and Programs. Mr. Stone.
All right. 813. Serendipitously, I just have two items to report on in the General Manager's Report tonight. I wanted to provide a brief update on the status of SCVWA versus Whitaker case. As you no doubt recall, the case, which was both a jury trial on common law claims and a bench trial on CERCLA-related claims, was conducted in U.S. District Court in late 2021. It resulted in a jury judgment at that time in our favor, and then a final judgment entered by the district judge June of 2022, the net effect being about a $65.9 million judgment in favor of SCV Water, the plaintiff. Subsequently, Whitaker appealed the case, which was expected. We also filed a cross appeal on a couple of matters, and it was referred to the appellate court, in this case, the Ninth District Circuit Court, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Briefings have been taking place over a period of time as things wind their way through. But finally, last Thursday, we reached another milestone, which was a 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit heard oral arguments at the historic courthouse in Pasadena. And it was quite an interesting step in the case, gets us closer to an outcome. It's not my intent in open session to go into a lot of strategic specifics, but I'll just say in general, we were encouraged by the tenor of the questions in the discussion, both with the appellate's case on the other side and our cross complaint on our cross appeal on our side. May not be a clean sweep, but we felt pretty good coming out of there. We won't know that outcome until a decision is actually published. And then finally, if you are interested and you find your way to the Ninth District Court of Appeals website, you can find the actual audio and video of that session under the archived audio and video items, which is down on the left-hand side. And I know at least one director will probably tee that up instead of the playoffs this weekend. So, Director Colley. Okay. Yeah. For those not seeing the video at home, he's leaning over in anticipation. I also wanted to report that I had an opportunity to meet with MWD's general manager, Adele Hadji Khalil, the week before last, kind of on that earlier topic. We just had been trying to arrange a sit down for some time. We've met at different functions over the last 2.5 years that he's been in that very challenging role at MWD, and finally had a chance to have a nice chat on a Friday. Talked about various things going on at our respective agencies and sort of where we think our mutual interests and issues and water resources align for future discussions. I thought it was a very good, productive session, and some of what I related to you about where they are in their process came in part from a check-in with him on that discussion. So look forward to hopefully further opportunities. With our fellow state water contractors and our fellow agencies in our own watershed as well, there's always opportunity to try to keep communication open and find new ideas, new cooperative ventures. And there are likely some things that we will be working together on in the future. So I was welcome that opportunity from someone who's very busy with a lot of things on his plate. So that's it. That'll keep my report short. It is now 8 17 and a half.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. We have a public comment on Mr. Stone's report.
We do not.
Very good. Any other comment or discussion from Director Armitage?
I'll just say that you piqued my interest greatly with what you just said. And I hope more information dribbles our way about that. I think I love hearing about potential collaborative, regional collaborative projects. And so I look forward to more.
Thank you. I mean, I could elaborate a little bit. I just didn't want to get into too big a laundry list, but, you know, obviously we both share interest in the operation of Castaic Lake as the two agencies with a share of that facility, as well as we take water, you know, from their lower feeder. It comes in through our service area and we pull water off of that. Beyond that, you know, we're both looking at storage. We're both investors or potential investors in sites. We both have the DCP decision and process there. They invested in the first phase of the AVEC storage project. There's a second phase that we're both in discussions with AVEC about. So there's some logical potential interest there if that idea moves along further. Part of that idea might also include an opportunity to make a physical interconnection back to the West Branch from that storage facility, rather than to the East Branch and then just delivering everything by trades. So all of those are areas, and there could be others that extend even beyond that. But I think having those discussions opens doors and gets people thinking about where our interests align a little bit more. The other thing is, because I worked in that arena for a long time, I have a very ongoing appreciation for some of the good things Metropolitan has done in its history. You know, no large mega agency is going to get it right 100% of the time, but they've done some pretty amazing things in the history of the agency and made some moves that have changed the course in integrated planning and other areas. And I may also want to just take that opportunity to convey to Adele my support and presence as a resource or anything else he might need for perspective in kind of diving into the middle of it, because it's a pretty big undertaking. But he's a very sharp person, and I think is trying to navigate an era where there's a lot of really difficult decisions to be made. So.
Right. Any other questions or comments from the board? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Stone. We can move on to item 8, committee meeting recap reports for informational purposes only. There was only one report in your packet, happened to be the engineering and operations committee meeting. Is there any public comment on item 8?
There is not.
There is none. Any questions or comments about the report in item 8? Very good. We can move on to item 9, president's report. We'll update the board on some items outside of the agency conferences and events. The Santa Clara Valley Chamber of Commerce 2024 awards and installation will be on February 2, 2024 at the Hyatt Regency at 6 p.m. The Urban Water Institute Spring Conference in Palm Springs will be February 21 to 23 in Palm Springs. Please check your emails for any additional events. Upcoming board meetings, there'll be a special board meeting on February 5th at 6 p.m. on ethics training for the board. And regular board meetings will be on February 6, 2024, 6 p.m. and February 20, 2024, 6 p.m. in this room. Upcoming committee meetings held at Summit Circle in the EWS boardroom, 5:30 p.m., the February 14th Water Resources and Watershed Committee, the February 15th Public Outreach and Legislation Committee, and the February 1st, 2024 Engineering and Operations Committee was canceled. Upcoming committee meetings at Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant in the boardroom right here, February 19th, Finance and Administration Committee meeting was moved to February 26th. Some additional information for the board. The agency will be closed on Monday, February 19th in observance of President's Day. That concludes my report. Is there any public comment, Madam Secretary?
There is not.
Are there any board questions on the report? Seeing none, we can move on to item 10, AB 1234 reports. There was one report included in your board packet. Are there any other AB 1234 reports tonight? Director Cooper.
Yes, I have two I'd like to report. One is the Santa Clarita Valley Groundwater Sustainability Agency, met on January 8th in this room. And then on January 11th, I attended the Aqua Region 8 board meeting at Upper San Gabriel Valley Municipal Water District.
That's all. Very good. Director Marks.
I, too, attended the January 8th GSA meeting. In addition, today I attended the Aqua Sigma Implementation Subcommittee, where they discussed the pending DWR guidance documents. Also, gave us a heads up on AB 828 by Connolly, which deals with the increasing responsibility of GSAs to address disadvantaged communities and wetlands, while also apparently restricting their ability to allocate water away from those resources. So just give the Ledge Committee a heads up.
Thank you, Director Mark. Director Armitage.
Thank you. On January 9th, I attended a virtual meeting with another member of the executive committee of the Special Districts Association of North LA County, and the two of us were tasked with finalizing the strategic plan to present as a draft to the rest of the executive committee for approval for a meeting tomorrow. And then earlier today, I had my one-on-one with General Manager Stone, enjoyed my conversation. We had interesting conversation about kind of what's happening in the Val Verde area, information about LA County Waterworks District 36, and kind of the issues that are happening with the Chiquita landfill and kind of how that affects potentially the water in that area. So I appreciated that conversation, and I look forward to learning more kind of as I keep my ears open as that conversation continues to evolve. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Armitage. Any other AB 1234s? This side, that side. Okay, I have a couple to report on. Once again, I'm along with the others. January 8th GSA board meeting held in this office. I also attended the January 9th monthly meeting with Graham Bradner, who you met this afternoon, this evening at the meeting. We discussed issues, a lot of which revolved around their presentation tonight. That was a Zoom meeting, and on January 12th, I attended the DCA board prep, where three members of the board, less than a majority, to sit down with virtually, that is, with staff, including Ms. Buckman and Graham Bradner and general counsel and other members of the staff that are necessary for the discussion, discuss various issues relative to the upcoming board meeting on the January 24th. Schedule and budget update, public outreach effort update, and a discussion of the environmental manager on the work they're doing moving forward. That concludes my AB 1234. We have any public comments on those AB 1234 reports?
We do not, but for clarification, Director Marks, was your meeting with Aqua was this Sigma that you talked about earlier this evening, was that virtual?
Virtual, yes.
Thank you.
That concludes item 10. AB 1234 reports. We move to item 11, director reports. Are there any director reports tonight? Director Armitage.
Thanks. So I just wanted to share that I know at the last board, or maybe two board meetings ago, General Manager Stone shared about the document that's called the Popular Annual Comprehensive Financial Review. I hope I got that right. Okay. Thank you. And encourage us all to go to the website to read it. And I did. And it's fantastic. I just want to say that this is such a great document. And it's written so well in a way I think that everybody can understand. And it's such a great summary document that I think the title gives it disservice. It doesn't make it welcoming to read. And I know for Ms. Patterson, like, we have to call it that for award purposes. But maybe once we're done with that award, we can maybe add a sexier title to it or something. I don't know. It's a great document. And I hope that we find ways to get that out and get people to read it, because I think it will help people get an understanding of all the great work that is done by this agency. So I just wanted to share that. And I know we'll be getting copies soon, because I was like, can you give copies to the public committee? I'm sorry, my brain's tired. Our committee on Thursday, but they're going to be giving us a copy, so we all have a hard copy as well. So thank you for everybody who did work on that. It's such a great document, and I just wanted to bring attention to that. Thank you.
Any other director reports? Is there a public comment on Director Armitage's report?
There is not.
Very good. Thank you. Move on to item 12, closed session. We will be going into closed session. The public may stay on the Zoom webinar. Any board members or staff that are connected to the Zoom and are in closed session, please disconnect from Zoom. We will meet in closed session to discuss item 12.1. All right, members of the public and any staff may stay on the current line. And once closed session is over, the board will reconnect to Zoom webinar and closed session announcements, and remaining items, agenda items, will be taken. Unless there's a need to, I guess there is a need to take a break. We will be taking a brief break. Try to be back by 8:40. We are now in recess. We are back in open session, and we can move to item 13, closed session announcements. Mr. Bunn.
Mr. President, members of the board met in closed session to discuss the item of lease negotiations listed in the agenda. No reportable action was taken under the Brown Act.
Thank you. We move to item 14, director requests for future agenda items. Are there any requests for future agenda items? Seeing none, there's no need for public comment, and we move on to item 15, adjournment. Thank you all. We are hereby adjourned.